Welcome to Between the Covers on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Public Radio. Interviews about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Avi Marr. Julia Glass is the author of 7 novels. Her first novel, 3 Junes, won the National Book Award. She has received fellowships from the National Endowment of the Arts, the New York Foundation for the Arts, and the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. Her short fiction has won the Tobias Wolff Award and the Pirates Alley Faulkner Society Medal. She is Senior Distinguished Writer in Residence at Emerson College. Her latest novel is called Vigil Harbor. She lives with her family in Massachusetts. Welcome to Between the Covers, Julia Glass.
Well, thank you so much, Avi. I'm thrilled to be here.
So I know that you've said your novels begin for you with a character in a situation. So what was the germ of this novel? Which character and situation came to you first?
Well, okay. So Vigil Harbor is a novel I actually started almost 10 years ago. And that's a long time ago compared to most of my other books. And it did indeed start with a character. Actually, I wanted to write about an architect who built homes on the coast. Sometimes it's not only a matter of a character coming to me, but I become really obsessed with a certain profession. And I think not because I know about it, but because I want to know about it. So I've written about reference librarians and preschool teachers and dog mushers and precocious teenage musicians, none of which I've ever been. And then so I can sort of delve into a character in two ways. Because one thing that really interests me with all my major characters is their relationship to whatever it is they do for employment or for passion. So that's how this started. And my idea about him, and it had to do with a conversation I'd had with a friend who disclosed to me that he'd had a very, very early, very impulsive marriage to an extraordinarily charismatic, but fragile woman. He married her like 6 weeks after meeting her. Marriage fell apart fast. And so, although I didn't tell my friend this, I sort of got this idea, what if this architect who has a very controlled life, as many architects do, and it's years later and he's married happily, but he's never told his wife about this very early, disastrous, tragic relationship that he had. So that was the seed.
So it was Austin.
Yeah. So it was Austin. And normally what would happen is I would just really marinate in that character. For instance, immediately I think of who are the character's parents? Does the character have children? Who are the co-workers? Who are the neighbors? And it's like a tree, you know, all these branches sort of grow out of this trunk. And I like to say to my students, my writing students, that for me, plot is nothing more than the choices my characters make going forward. And that's how I write a novel, you know, forward into the dark, as it were. But something else funny happened, and I haven't told this story much. I told it at an event recently, but around the time that I was beginning to think about Austin Kepner and his coastal town, very much based on my own coastal town here in Massachusetts, I have a very good friend who's a historical novelist. And she was working on a novel about the pirate Jean Lafitte. And she was doing all this research on hurricanes and sailing craft of the 19th century and also maritime superstitions and mythologies. And we were also talking at the time, one night, very enviously, about a certain huge bestseller that was very popular with women and very sexy. And she said to me, let's write a soft porn novel together, but with mermaids. And she said, and it's going to be bigger than Shades of Grey. So we had a little much wine.
Was there wine involved?
There was wine involved. Yes, there was. Perhaps rosé, I can't say. So there we were discussing, and her husband kept walking in and out of the living room shaking his head. You know, he's an economist. So it's like, oh my God, those girls are going at it again. And so of course we weren't serious. Although sometimes she'll bug me about it and say, so when are we going to write that pornography with the mermaids? And somehow, and I had mermaids on the brain. And this is so unlike me. And as I said to this gathering the other day, anybody who knows my previous novels would assume that I was, you know, struck on the head with a heavy object, that I actually thought, what if this woman in this man's past is someone who believed herself to be a sea creature of some kind? And was she, wasn't she, you know, and what if some other person out of that woman's past, yeah, never forgotten her, suddenly shows up at Austin Kepner's doorstep? So there I was, and I was I was also thinking, this is the part where clearly I was on something. I thought, well, maybe she really, really is a mermaid. And maybe I'm going to write about, maybe I'm going to write my magical realism novel. What happened next is that, and this won't surprise you, I got stuck, you know, and I found myself procrastinating like crazy. Now, I am not a write every day kind of writer. I don't believe you have to. I mean, it's important to kind of daydream about your characters, but I'll go stretches of weeks without putting a word on the screen. And then I sort of write. I write in sprints. But I found myself one day when I really knew I ought to be writing. I've forgotten the year, but it was the terrible shootings at the Charlie Hebdo editorial offices in Paris. It was the day after those shootings. And there was a manhunt going on in Paris where they were looking for those two gunmen. I watched that manhunt on YouTube for 3 hours instead of working on this novel. And I thought, I'm really in trouble because this is not, it's not me. And then something else happened. And it's a long story, so I won't go into how it happened, but I began to cheat on this novel. Now, I began to think about a whole different set of characters. And I describe myself as a novelist, as a serial monogamist. When I am working on a novel, there's nothing on the side. There aren't even, I don't know how people write short stories and novels. I mean, I've done it, but rarely. I am, you know, committed to the novel I'm working on till publication do us part. And suddenly, though, I was kind of secretly cavorting with a famous children's book author and his assistant, a British movie star, and a museum curator, and in an entirely different plot. And honestly, I felt seriously guilty. I thought that I'm having an affair. And I created this kind of clandestine file on my desktop. And I'd sort of let myself visit that file at lunchtime. And then I thought, what's going on here? I'm not writing the novel about the architect and the mermaid. I am writing this other novel. And I had a contract for the architect novel, which by the way, was titled In a Time of Tempests, for all the way up to the 11th hour, till 6 months ago. But after talking to my agent, she said, just write the novel you want to write. They don't care that it's not going to have the synopsis that you basically faked. Because that's the funny thing. To get a contract, you have to write, or I have to write a synopsis. And since I usually don't know what's going to happen, I just make stuff up.
Yeah.
And I try to approximate what I think might happen. But, and so I turned away from the novel I thought I was writing, and I wrote A House Among the Trees. And that book came out in 2017. And then I had to decide, you know, what am I going to do here? Am I going to go back to this dusty, abandoned novel, which, by the way, I had written about 150 or 200 pages of. And there were other characters in it, some of which remain in the finished book, some of whom don't. And, you know, my joke in the author's note in the back is that it's, yeah, we went to marriage counseling, me and this novel, and, you know, and I gritted my teeth. But then here's what happened. So imagine, you know, I'd been originally writing that book in, you know, 13, 14, 15, before I put it aside. And then I come to this fork in the road in the year 2017. Uh-huh. And boy, has the world changed. I actually looked this up the other day because I was, you know, it's interesting that I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about how I got back into this book until the last few weeks, realizing people are going to ask me about it. June 1st of 2017, I was pulling into the parking lot of my local garden center. I was going to buy a tree. And what was on NPR, but an imminent address by our president, who, as I was sitting in the parking lot, and I, you know, I did that thing where you did, don't get out of the car because it's, and he withdrew the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. And I sat in the parking lot of my garden center, trees all around me, just, and I cried. I cried for about 10 minutes, thinking about my children, thinking about everybody. And I just thought, how can we be here? How can we, how have we arrived at this moment? And here I am contemplating going back into writing about this coastal town where this architect builds these houses designed to withstand these furious storms. I mean, we in Massachusetts are very lucky, and that's part of what the book is about too. I mean, thus far, we are, I mean, when there's a terrible hurricane down south, we get what I call the petticoats. We get hard rain for a few days and some wind. But 2017, as it turned out, was also a year of exceptionally severe weather. And again, I looked this up. In the year 2017, there were 17 named storms, 10 of which were hurricanes. And three of those hurricanes were Harvey, Irma, and Maria, which respectively devastated Houston, Puerto Rico, other cities. I'm thinking about Houston in particular and Puerto Rico in particular, but it was a lot more of the, you know, southern extremities of this country and tropical. And I thought, you know, I don't want to write a political novel. You know, I've never set out to write a political novel. What happens in my novels is that the characters I write about intersect with history, as we all do, whether it's, is gay marriage legal? I mean, and that was kind of an issue in The Widower's Tale, I think, when it was only legal in Massachusetts at the time. So my characters collide with or rub up against whatever, you know, the anxieties, fears, and political, you know, missions, activism of their times are. But this time I felt I really had to think about climate in my book. And I thought, here's another thing I thought. So once we're out of the climate accord and we're, you know, seem to be fingers in our ears about what's clearly science, what's clearly happening. And I thought, how can these climate scientists and these climate activists, how can they bear what's happening? And what if they decided that the only way to make themselves heard and taken seriously is to turn to violence, to turn to terrorism? I thought, you know, that just might be justified. And so I thought, what if in, say, about a decade from now, things haven't become, you know, miraculously better. You know, hopefully, I was telling myself there in 2017, hopefully we have a new president by 12 years from now. But still, the damage is still being done everywhere. So that's when I thought, you know, I'm definitely going to have a character who's a marine biologist. And that's Mike, a character of whom I became very, very fond. It's interesting to talk to people who've read the book now because people have different favorites. But, and as I described Mike to someone while I was working on the book as a depressed marine biologist, and the response from the person was, what marine biologist wouldn't be depressed? So then I thought, okay, I'm writing about this small town that in a way is quite, it's privileged not only because it's mostly white, educated, affluent people, but it's accidentally privileged by its, you know, geopolitical, its topographical status, because the town I live in, which is actually Marblehead, Massachusetts, is a peninsula. So it's quite open to the storms, and nor'easters, which are the big winter storms, just smash our harbor full on, to the extent that when there's a weather prediction, all the news trucks from the Boston networks just come and park on our harbor and wait for the storm to arrive because it's so dramatic. You get these huge storm surges, but we're up on a granite headland. So actually, although, you know, the sea level is predicted to rise most of all in the sort of northern Atlantic coast of North America. And you know, we are seeing that in increments. As a town, we're sort of up on this pedestal. And the homes that are actually on the coast are up to some degree. It's not like Cape Cod. And I spend, you know, I'm very involved in a number of literary and artistic ventures in Provincetown, which is the very tail end of Cape Cod. And every summer when I go there, I really notice the erosion. Houses are being put up on stilts. It's, you know, the Cape is in a great deal of peril. So, but what about this town, you know, where these people all know one another, you know, live in a sort of mutual comfort zone? Maybe they're not all politically like-minded, but most of them, you know, are very proud of their liberal thinking. They're also proud of living in a town that has a very rich, long history that goes back to the 17th century, when it was settled by cod fishermen, and then in the American Revolution, when it was actually a hotbed of insurgency. And some of what I talk about when I talk about the history of the town and the pride in the history is some people don't realize that those so-called patriots, I mean, the way we use the word patriot now is different. Patriots were essentially terrorists. They were insurgents. They were overthrowing a king and a whole government. So I thought that makes a kind of interesting backdrop to a world in which terrorism, domestic terrorism, and terrorism in the name of various forms of activism, not just religion, you know, is escalating. And so what if New York and other cities are suffering nothing on the scale of 9/11. I wasn't going to go that deep. But incidents in which there are small bombs, truck bombs, and even suicide bombers, and people, you know, live with a higher degree of law enforcement vigilance, which is never perfect. So that's how I conceived of Brecht. And Brecht is a 22-year-old young man who was in his sophomore year of college when he narrowly escaped a bombing on Union Square in Lower Manhattan. And understandably, he came home, and he's in a state of post-traumatic stress. I do not like to overuse the word trauma, but he's certainly someone who's been subject to trauma. And so he's living with his mother, who's married to Austin, the architect, and he is working for Celestino, who is a Guatemalan immigrant who settled in this town, married to Connie, who grew up in Vigil Harbor. And so Celestino is unusual, and that is, I think Brecht says, he's one of the few brown people in this very white town, but he's respected, he has a good business. But even Celestino is fearful for his status, because in this world that I'm writing about 12 years in the future, immigration policies are tougher as well. I just wanted to imagine a world in which the volume is turned up on all the fears and anxieties we have. But it's not that there isn't hope. It's not that people aren't working very hard to if not fix, make life as good as it can possibly be.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Portland 90.7. I love that you're bringing up, and it was one of my questions, is the amount of time from the present moment that the, yeah. That I like what you're saying about, I wanted to increase the volume on, this is not news. right? Yeah. Each of the things that you're talking about domestic terrorism and climate events, these are all things that are already here. And that was one of my questions specifically, is how did you pick this thin slice of time rather than a big imaginary future? So
in the beginning, I kind of fudged it. I now had to do the math, you know, and I'll tell you why. I know I'm talking very circuitously here, but here's something that I see as a little bit paradoxical. The nearer the future you are writing about, the smaller your margin of error. So here's what happened. I had basically almost finished a draft of this book. In fact, what greatly accelerated my getting closer to the end was that in February of 2020, I was invited to go to a women's writers retreat, 14 of us, all women writers, February of 2020. I wrote 50 pages of this book in 10 days. Incredible. And had gained about 10 pounds. And while we're there, you know, the newspaper has all this stuff about this virus in Wuhan and I remember I got an email from a friend whose husband is a scientist involved in the future of healthcare in Arizona. And she said, Bill says to go and buy high quality surgical masks. And I'm thinking, let's not get hysterical here. That's February of 2020. I get home February 27th and we all know what happened within 2 weeks. So like a lot of writers, I couldn't write. I mean, I couldn't look at my novel. I could barely read a book. I was doom scrolling like everybody, you know, and I was watching the heroic Mayor Cuomo of New York every day with my lunch. You know, how times change, right? It's like, he's going to get us through. Anyway, and that summer of 2020, I thought, okay, once again, you know, me and this novel, I mean, it's like we're star-crossed, because how can I have written a book that takes place only 10 or 12 years in the future and not have COVID in it? You know, I knew fully well in the summer of 2020 that even if they got us a vaccine pretty soon, that this is not over. I knew that. I thought, what am I going to do here? And then something occurred to me. Everyone, and this is typical of all my novels, all my characters have sorrows and disappointments and heartbreaks in their past. And I thought, what if some of those sorrows and heartbreaks were directly related to having lived through COVID? And so Brecht's father, and this is not a spoiler, as I told you, Brecht's mother is married to Austin Kepner, and Brecht is his stepson. And in my original draft, Brecht's father had died of asthma in New York City when he was a boy. And I thought, well, what if he died of COVID in that first wave in New York? He was an asthmatic and he died of COVID. And what if COVID and its aftermath is part of what made Austin decide? Because originally he does start out his life as an architect at a big firm in New York. That was always true. What if part of his leaving New York to come to this coastal village is the reason a lot of people left? You know, that you don't have that degree of risk tolerance. And yet life goes on. And so in my mind, I mean, you know, between now and 12 years from now, it's entirely possible that an even worse plague will emerge. It's also, Ukraine is not in my book. I mean, it's possible that Putin will go over the edge and lob a ballistic missile at us. I mean, I don't, you know, please no. But I mean, often, and abortion may be completely illegal in this entire country by 12 years from now. You know, all sorts of things can happen. But it doesn't matter how accurate the micro details of my world that I've made up are. People are being faced with a lot of big existential questions. how are we going forward into the future and how are we coping with this? But again, I've made this sound like a political novel, haven't I? I mean, it's really a novel about people in a town and their reliance on one another and how they get through betrayals. So, you know, Mike, the marine biologist, is sort of thrown together in a kind of mortifying way with this character, Margot, who's everybody's favorite English teacher from the high school, because their spouses run away with each other.
Can you read us a bit from the book?
Sure, I'd love to. So let me introduce this a little bit. So I've talked about how several of the characters are longtime residents of this town, Vigil Harbor. But as is often the case when you want to get a story moving, some strangers come to town, and there are two strangers who come separately to town. And one of them is from Celestino's past, Celestino being the Guatemalan landscape architect. And the other one is a woman who comes from Austin's past. And as I've talked a little bit earlier about what happened to him in his youth in New York, you'll put this together. So this woman's name is Petra, and she is here recalling that recently she very suddenly lost her wife in New York, who died of a massive stroke. And her wife's name is Carly. I turned 54 3 weeks after Carly died. Friends sent cautiously festive messages by all the too many means of connection we now have. I answered none of them. I started the day in our pink tiled shower, where it occurred to me that I had now lived 1 year for every card in a full deck, if you count the jokers. And count them, you always should. Looking back, I could actually regard some years as red in feeling, others black. Some years had been as sparse in luck or joy, or conversely, as chaste or serene, as an ace of clubs on a field of white, while others were Byzantined with patterns designed to complement a woman's cunningly jeweled tresses, or conceal a knave's fist clutching the hilt of a dagger. Queen of Hearts, the year I met Carly. Jack of Diamonds, the year I got that one decent film role, the one I thought might turn my fortunes around. But oh, if ever there were a joker in the pack, it would have been the year I turned 29, the year of Issa. Or was that one my Queen of Hearts? Treason to Carly that I should even waver. Which rates the greater score in love, the queen or the ace? How about hearts versus diamonds? To those who'd misread me as a gold digger, I suppose Carly was my queen of diamonds. After my birthday shower, during which I cried a Venetian canal, I went out and ate an uncharacteristically enormous breakfast at a place on Columbus Avenue that Carly and I had never set foot in, or at least I hadn't. It was a fern-filled bistro renowned as a hetero-dominant pickup bar in the evenings, a young mother's rendezvous after another kind of pickup, that of the kiddies from preschool. So it was still mostly empty when I took a booth by the window and found on the seat one of those thick, shiny architecture rags that have so far survived the encroaching death of print. In a state of pure sloth, I paged through it without much interest while I waited for my Lumberjane special, pancakes, eggs, yogurt with pine cone granola, more calories than I generally consume in an entire day. Just as I was about to toss the magazine aside, I happened on a spread showing a house tucked into a hillside overlooking a meadow confettied with flowers. Desirable as it might have been, it wasn't the house that sent blood rushing to my face. It was the headline, or really just the name. View becomes vision, another Austin Kepner gem. I read every word of the article, and at the end, I looked into the face cameoed against another picture of the house and said, "So there you are." Here he was, a man I had met only once in passing, decades before, yet for whom I had dreamed nothing but daggers. Was Kepner my Jack of Spades? I consider it no insult to Carly that I am on a mission to avenge, if not track down, Issa.
Can you read us a bit from a different narrator?
Sure. I'll actually read from Brecht. And he is, as I said earlier, the young man who's come back from New York in a state of shock and stress after having just survived one of those domestic attacks. I'm going to take a sip of water, though, first. Okay. And this is actually almost the very beginning of the book itself. Like every basic Saturday night, the windows in my room are shaking in their frames. Not an earthquake, but my stepfather's music. He stays up way late and plays it so maxed up, basso profundo, that the walls in the living room vibrate clear to the third floor. It pumps through my veins, frazzles my nerves. He gets a river of random heritage tune shop flowing along, thump, thump, thump. Everything from Nina Simone to Code Dread. And whether there are guests, or it's just him and mom, or even just him, he dances. Austin is a dance maniac. He says dance is his number one narcotic. But sometimes he also breaks out that champion leaf he gets from he won't say where. He promises mom it's throwback, the kind they swear won't pickle your judgment. And it does have a smell more like some weird-ass tea, less like skunk. He only smokes if it's just him or he's only with mom, though I don't think she smokes. Austin would never smoke with clients and all friends, he claims, plus even strangers you pass on the street, are future, if not past or present clients. So the whole basic world is a client. Sometimes I vexed him to turn it down. Maybe he does, by a margin that doesn't matter. He'll yell up the stairs, "Earplugs, dude," in that diluvian but who cares tone. And I'm like, what if I slept through something asteroidal? Austin says, don't be melodramatic. He says I'm a doomseer, too typical of my generation. He says it lightly in a faux jokey voice. But when he doesn't think I'm in earshot, I've heard him refer to Generation F, failure, fatalist. Take your pick. If you want to get poetic, flotsam. Others call us Generation NL, out loud, nil. No life, as in having no lives worth living, or maybe as in get a life, which it's true a lot of us cannot seem to do, or not according to some fossil definition of grown up, as in going out there to be something. People who are hard on us like that tell us to look at the kids who came of age in the pandemic years, the ones who survived and even somehow figured out how to live lives of their own while ducking in and out of lockdown during the surges. Austin, who has no kids genetically his own, says our allergy to independence, that's what he calls it, is the fault of our parents, but collectively, not individually, because he wouldn't want to get mom too far down. I was 12 when she married Austin, so there wasn't much he could do, he says, except root from the sidelines, as if me and mom or some kind of sporting event. It's so obviously not her fault that I boomeranged home, that I'm in this state she sees as deep limbo, but she's always felt responsible for who I am. I think she can't help feeling guilty about us losing dad, which is nuts, but I get it. Maybe it's also middle age and the whole mortality thing. She's in this fragile place right now. I guess we are doomseers, me and my friend Noam, and the rest of us, but why shouldn't we be?
If you're just tuning in, this is Between the Covers on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. So I think I counted 8 main narrators, as well as interspersed omnisciently narrated chapters, and also secondary characters like the dumper spouses.
You know, one of the, again, this is another of the pros of writing forward in the dark and not planning things out. Characters surprise me. I mentioned earlier that Austin was the appointed protagonist of the novel I originally conceived. And, you know, he has a voice, but he is definitely not one of the primary protagonists. In fact, someone told me, you know, he's kind of boring. I said, well, he leads a very controlled life. I mean, partly because he has this terrible folly in his past, but also he's successful and he has a reputation around town. And you can sort of picture he's very fashionable and goes to the yacht club and so on. So Austin wasn't, you know, the more charismatic one. In fact, Brecht, who emerges as such an important voice, if never in a million years would I have intended to have someone that young be so important, because I'm actually pretty terrified of writing about younger, cooler people. I'd far rather write about somebody who's in their 90s than somebody who's in their 20s. Of course, now I'm in my 60s, so I'm closer. So saying that is not, I'm farther from my 20s. But, you know, and one of the things, and you get a little hint of it there with Brecht, is that language is evolving in the mouths of the very young. And so there are some slang words that he'll use throughout the book that, you know, the adults, you know, don't use so much because he is in that generation that is shaping, you know, the next generation of English. So Brecht is very important. And also I spoke about the marine biologist, Mike, who's very important, and his wife, you know, leaves him for the husband of someone else. And they are two couples well-known in the sort of yacht club society. So it's quite mortifying for both of them. And of course they wonder, did everybody know their spouses were having this affair? And of course, fortunately the spouses split, they leave town. But Margot is someone I suddenly found a great deal of pleasure in. She's retired from being the English teacher at the public high school that, I think, as I put it, every child dreads they're going to have and every parent wants their child to have. She makes you memorize. She makes you, you know, do Shakespeare soliloquies. But, you know, outside the classroom, she kind of swears like a sailor. And she is in a rage. Mike, whose wife has left him, is kind of depressed. But Margot is fury. And she, you know, and I sort of wondered to myself, I don't know how plausible this is, but then I really loved it as I wrote about it. She just basically shows up at Mike's house and takes him by the scruff of the neck and says, you know, you are not going to sink into, you know, some sort of depressed oblivion. You know, we're going to get our revenge. We're going to take them for everything they're worth. And they both have grown children. And Mike's relationship to his grown daughter and son also became very important, so that even Mike's son, who's a gay struggling actor in New York and keeps his father awake at night as his father thinks of him living in this dangerous city. New York is increasingly dangerous, but it's still very glamorous. It's still a hub of the arts. And his son is 30 years old and still trying to make it as an actor. And then at some point I decided, we're going to actually not only meet the son, but we're going to hear the son. So the son has a secondary role in the narration as well. Not as important as his father, but, and then of course, you know, the danger that Mike and many people believe is beyond the town borders, suddenly it's right there on their doorstep. And of course I won't give away how that happens, but the climax of the book are the events on a very, very dramatic day when a lot of people's lives are suddenly in very grave danger. So Petra, I read a little bit of her. You know, I knew she was going to be important, this woman who also was in love with the woman that the very young woman that Austin was married to years and years ago in New York. And she, you know, shows up. I mean, her mission is a little deranged, you know, but she's in a state of denial that she's really, that she should be mourning the loss of her wife, Carly, who was a wonderful woman. So, you know, people who are listening to this interview are like, there is no way I am reading a book with so many people. But, you know, the thing about my characters is I promise, you know, I always, the guarantee I have for my readers is that you will be very fully grounded in each of my most important characters. I have to say that one of the greatest compliments to me is that a lot of my fans are psychotherapists. Why? Because I drill down so deep into my characters. If you do not like flashbacks, then please don't buy my books, you know, because every character's history, you know, here's something that emerged that I found, sometimes I actually cry a little, like, and authors will say, if you can't make yourself cry at scenes where you want the reader to cry, then what good are you? And if you also, if you can't turn yourself on when you write a sexy scene, what could you? But there's a scene that I never thought I'd write about how Margot, this high school teacher who Egon, Mike's gay son, had as a teacher, and how in a very indirect way, she is the person who helped him come out.
Oh, I love and that scene. I love that scene. I cried at that scene.
Play, he's playing, you know, Henry Higgins, you know, Professor Higgins in Pygmalion, and she's asking him how he reads Higgins' relationship to women, you know, is he drawn to women, or and in that conversation, and I, you know, that's, you know, one of those moments when a writer, when you feel like you're in the zone, because the scene is just happening, you sat down to, and you just didn't know you were going to write this scene, and they're sitting in this high school classroom, you know, and I just, I loved that scene. I loved writing that scene. Eight narrators. You know, my novel, The Widower's Tale, has four.
I was going to say, they seem to be going up. Is this your highest?
Oh, yes. As far as protagonists, if you consider them, you know, maybe alpha and beta protagonists. Yes, those protagonists. And certainly the most first-person narrators. I'm, you know, I'm famous for mixing first-person with third-person. And I, you know, some people think you can't do that. And in this one, I just, you know, I actually moved around the order in which people appeared several times, which is complicated because the present action of this, of Vigil Harbor, is only a few days.
I'm going to say that the whole thing elapses in a few days. Yeah.
It's really, so every time that I decided, no, I want the reader to hear, say Margot before they hear Mike, it would mean that if I swapped, because I'm going chronologically, I had to change whose point of view you would get the current moment through. So, so, you know, really, you know, I think of this book as kind of Cat's Cradle, you know, that game with the string, that went, that writing it was like playing Cat's Cradle, because every time I changed something, you know, or added a character, it would have this effect on the rest of the structure. And I mean, in a way, the break that I had because of COVID paralysis in early 2020 gave me, it was a gift in a way, because it meant that I wasn't looking at the book for a period of months. And in some ways, I mean, not only was I able to figure out how COVID would fit this book, but I saw structural things that I wouldn't have seen as clearly if I had been just continuously working on it.
Our guest today is Julia Glass, speaking to us about her newest novel, Vigil Harbor.
Vigil Harbor falls into a genre that I've only learned since teaching. You know, now I'm learning all the vocabulary for.
Is there a name I don't know about? Please teach us.
Speculative fiction, right? Speculative, because speculates, right? But I joked to I was actually talking to the writer Karen Russell, who lives in Portland.
Oh, one of our beautiful Portlanders.
Such a lovely woman, and I won't claim we're close friends, but we have corresponded, and I had her come to Emerson and speak to our students, and she was amazing. But I wrote her an email, and I said, well, I'm writing a speculative novel, if you can believe it, Karen, but I said, it's baby steps speculative. And she loved that. She wrote me back, go baby steps. So, I mean, you know, it's fiction in an interesting place right now. Partly because you're seeing the broadening of what is considered literary fiction, the sort of hybridizing of genres. And, you know, some people are referring to Vigil Harbor as what's called cli-fi and, you know, climate fiction, sci-fi, cli-fi. And I kind of cringe at that because, again, that sounds so heavy-handedly political, and that's not what I intend. But, you know,
but that is realism right now. It's not, you're not making a giant leap. That's what I felt like, is this is the background within which these relational events are happening. Either you would be denying it if you weren't attending to it. I mean, like, so much of the book, I was going to ask an early question about one of the things you do so well is talk about place. And the book opens with an omniscient narrator speaking about Vigil Harbor and the
history of the town and
the history of the town, but also just about geography as destiny. Exactly. And that you take that up, that is how you open the book.
Where you live, you know, whether you chose to live there, weren't able to leave. I mean, who can't be haunted by the thought of what it means to be a Ukrainian, to live in a country that is invaded by a bully, that is, you know, bombed to the ground. I look at these pictures of farmers, you know, in the heartland of Ukraine and their farms destroyed. And I just, you know, we never know, you know, and a huge mother of a storm could hit this peninsula I live on. And, you know, I mean, Marblehead, I mean, I'm a sucker for antique houses. I live in an 1820 house, but this house is one of the youngest houses on the block. Marblehead actually has more houses built before 1776 than any town in America. So you have all these cheek by jowl, crickety old wooden houses, and it's a miracle they haven't burned to the ground. They haven't been blown away. And every time that a big nor'easter hits, and as I said, we're raised up, which is great from the point of view of the waves crashing, but from the wind point of view, it's, I lie in my bed at night, it's kind of scary, but you reassure yourself. You say, well, this house has been standing since 1820, so I'm fine. But, you know, that's what we all tell ourselves, right? Well, everything's been okay so far, so things have got to continue to be okay, right? Going back to place, I mean, also, I told you that the title of this book, until a few months ago, was In a Time of Tempests. And, you know, my editor I'm not great at titles. I tend to choose kind of florid titles. And my joke about that title is it's sort of like that really dramatic, colorful dress that you bought, but you kind of begin to realize you look more like a clown than elegant when you put it on. So my editor is very nice. And she said, you know, do you want to think about this title? Because is it really the title you want? And I said, oh, you know, I love, there's kind of a Shakespearean illusion. And I love that, you know, it tells people that it's dramatic. You know, you think storms, typhoons, hurricanes. But then I realized, you know what this book is about? This book is about a place. It's about a place and the forces that it exerts for good and for ill on the lives of the people who live there. And I said, it belongs to the family of novels that are titled with a place. And I thought Vigil Harbor, you know, that's a fine title. And in fact, a writer friend of mine wrote me last week and said how much he loves the title because he feels like it captures in two words where we are now. And I can't reproduce what he wrote. He's brilliant. And he said, it's one word, you know, vigil is, we are living in this moment of witness and warning, you
right,
know,
trepidation and hoping to survive. Yeah.
Perilous world. We are on vigil, but we remain a harbor. We still care for one another. We are in a place of if we're lucky, if we're fortunate, where we are kind of holding together. And that's, you know, a harbor is a place where you come home, where, you know, you sail home to safety and, you don't want to really fully recognize your themes until, you know, maybe when you're pretty far into the book, so you can bring them out into focus. But, you know, I'm about to go out, meet readers, and readers tell me things that I'm just, that are jaw-droppingly true about my own work.
So if I could segue into a question from that. So one of the things you've said about your first novel, about Three Junes, is that that later you were able to look back on it, and that it was written just after, in your 30s, where you had a really rough, brutal time with multiple losses and illness. And that looking back on it, you realized that Three Junes was really about unbearable heartbreak and what happens afterward.
Right.
Do you have any sense of sort of what your psyche was metabolizing during the writing of this book, especially now that you've helped us understand it was a decade that included some pretty intense American
history. Changes in our world, politically. You know, when I look back on Three Junes coming out of that triple whammy that I had, and I'll just say for those who don't know that within a period of a year, I went through a divorce, a diagnosis of cancer, and the loss of my sister, my only sibling, to suicide. In fact, she killed herself less than 2 weeks after I was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 36 years old. And, you know, I had actually written a short story about a widow, Scottish widower, that is really the seed for Three Junes. But then I went forward and I suddenly found myself writing about New York in the plague years, the worst years of the AIDS crisis, during which I had done volunteer work. So I met men who were dying. And somehow that entered the book in a way I hadn't expected. And only much later did I realize that it was this skewed way for me to write about my own enormous fears of mortality and my crippling grief, because it really was crippling for a while, over the loss of my wonderful sister. And so now, you know, I'm older and at least, you know, knock on wood, you know, I'm healthy. I'm, you know, my grown children are facing their challenges, but they're healthy and they're doing as well as they can be. Sometimes I wonder, you know, am I going to become a glib writer because I'm not, you know, living through horrible tragedies. But I think one of the things that really runs through this book like a spine is the fear of every parent now. Uh-huh. What the generations to come, that the existential lie awake at night fear and anxiety that those of us who are parents have about what is the future going to hold for our children? And there are times, you know, when my older son will say to me, you know, your generation really screwed this world up. Yeah. He uses a different word, of course, but I hope we can use that word that I used, you know, and look at what you did, you know, and what have you left us? And it's really sort of undeniable. I mean, what can I say? We're trying, you know, some of us are trying to make up for what we did, but that sometimes he expresses a level of despair that it's hard. Mm. It's hard to counteract. But you know, I'll say something. I think I pulled a book off my shelf the other day called The World According to Mr. Rogers. And and it's all quotes from Mr. Rogers. And there's one in there, I think this is where I saw this. Mm. And it was about when a child witnesses on television or in life something really terrifying and catastrophic. And I think of the fact that I had a 5-year-old in Lower Manhattan on 9/11. And he says, when your child is looking at all this terrifying stuff, tell them, look for the helpers. There are always helpers. Mm. And that moved me so much. There will always, you know, whatever dangers we go through, there will always be those who are there to help. Yeah. You know, when the younger generations despair, you know, but they still want to have their families and they still want to find ways to be optimistic, you know, look for the helpers and let's be the helpers. Mm. I want to be corny, but And if I look back on what my, you know, triple whammy in my 30s, you know what? That's the period in my life that turned me into an optimist. It's the tragedies and getting through them that made me an optimist.
That's a lovely way for us to sort of come in for a landing. Anyway, it was a joy to spend time with you, Julia. Thank you so much.
I'm so glad that this auction brought us together.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll talk again.
I hope so. I would love to.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Between the Covers here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM with original music from John Bechtel. If you'd like to hear the longer version of this talk, head to kboo.org.